You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, May 18th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report, Michael Thursday. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sarah Jones of the New Republic on why the New York Times editorial page is terrible, the deification of Hillary Clinton, and why that matters for the future of progressive and left politics, and how we, quote-unquote, hashtag resist. Robert Mueller, he's the new special counsel, former FBI director. He's going to continue the Russia investigation. Chaffetz might be out sooner than sooner. He really, really wants to get out of Congress. I wonder why. Donald Trump, still in peak mental and physical condition, blunders through, and he is so enraged at the incompetence of his staff that he's thinking of bringing in someone with organizational capacity, discipline, and structure to get the whole thing running like a well-oiled machine. That's right, Corey Lewandowski might be returning to frontline American politics.
Just got to take problems by the arm.
I'm going to take problems by the arm. And Labour Party in the UK slightly cutting Conservative Party's lead. UKIP disappearing, the Green Party taking their place. And Lib Dems falling from 14 to 7%. Not looking good. Maintaining, though, that the problem is not the left platform. It's the persona and strategic decisions, unfortunately, of Jeremy Corbyn and Roger Ailes in a boon to the legal settlement division of Fox News and health plan for companies he's involved in has finally passed away. And an associate of Roger Ailes would just like to say, did not see that one coming. Not exactly good with the cardio, if you know what I'm saying. We'll play a clip of some of his former minions. Goodbye, Roger. It's the Hotline Bling music. It's finally my opportunity to dance on a grave. Can you get... I wish you were in the shot too, Matt. Matt's popping and rolling. Man, I wish I didn't wake up. I woke up feeling a little sick this morning.
Good way to kick off summer.
Yeah, it was a good way to kick. I was feeling a little bit under the weather, and then I turned over to my visitor, and I said, because I was looking at my phone, I said, Roger Ailes is dead. And she was like, who the hell is Roger Ailes? And I said, this is why you're so much happier than me. You occupy a world. And she goes, oh, wait a second. Was it that guy at Fox? The harassment guy? I said, yes. We can keep...
You said be more specific.
Yeah, right, exactly. Be more specific. You can keep dropping in the Hotline Bling. I always thought we were going to come up with my own Dancing on Graves soundtrack, though. All right, but for now it's Hotline Bling, and I would like to
it's
have it.
It's just so stuck, that sound now. Every time I listen to that song, it reminds me of just like the good people, or the good deaths that have happened.
All right, let's give ourselves, because it is a really bleak time in this country, and things are falling apart. And we are, well, you know what? First, actually, let's do it in reverse order. The cast of Fox and Friends, the truly just a... I told you the story about how I was almost booked on Fox and Friends as like a young progressive to debate libertarian ideas. And I had a friend debate against libertarian ideas. And I had a friend who knew one of the producers there, and she was a media person, and she had booked me for another channel, and she, you know, recommended me to them, and they said, you know, and they took a look at, I don't know, one of my videos or something, one of my interviews, I think, on her channel, and they said, oh, okay, great, you know, got in touch with me. And they were doing more follow-up. And they said, yeah, can we just check your YouTube channel again before we do a final sign-off and we'll book a time. And then I realized that right at the time, like literally within 20 minutes of them checking my YouTube channel, we had just uploaded a video where I call Brian Kilmeade perhaps the stupidest person on planet Earth. And I never heard back from Fox and Friends. So now, that being said, here is Brian Kilmeade, Steve Doocy, Ainsley Earnhardt, and Janice Dean, four of the stupidest people on planet Earth, mourning the death of serial predator Roger Ailes. There's a lot of subtext here. We're going to play that, and then Matt and I will share our own reaction to his death.
I love you.
We learned some sad news this morning that our former CEO, Roger Ailes, passed away this morning, and we just want to remember him. He is dead at the age of 77 years old this morning.
That's right. And this is the statement from Elizabeth Ailes. She says, I'm profoundly sad and heartbroken to my report that my husband, Roger Ailes, passed away this morning. Roger was a loving husband to me, to his son, Zachary, and a loyal friend to many. He was also a patriot, profoundly grateful to live in a country that gave him so much opportunity to work hard, to rise, and to give back during a career that stretched over more than five decades. His work in entertainment, his work in politics, and in news affected the lives of many millions. And so even
That's
as
true.
We mourn his death, we celebrate his life.
Indeed. Roger Ailes helped build Fox News Channel into the powerhouse it is today. Roger would tell stories during our State of the Business meetings that he would hold twice a year here at Fox News about how he started in the business. He was actually a production assistant at stations in Cleveland and Philadelphia. He eventually worked his
Someone's
way up
crying.
To run the
Janice Dean
Douglas
is bawling her eyes out.
In 3 years, he went from PA to EP of the most successful daytime talk show maybe ever. That's he right. got the biggest guest to arrive in Ohio and do his show from Bob Hope on down.
Roger believed in hard work. He ran four political campaigns.
Roger Ailes, according to one report, inserted his penis in a woman's mouth and told her that she was now a whore and a servant for Roger Ailes. I guess that would be a form of hard work. Go ahead.
And many people out there would say that he saved this country by starting the Fox News Channel. Roger gave every single one of us on this couch an opportunity. He put food on our table. And, you know, he went out in such a sad way. But who doesn't have sins? We all have our sins. We all have our cross to bear. And, Roger, I will love you forever. You gave me an opportunity, and I will forever, ever, ever be grateful. I know I would not have gotten this job if it weren't for you. And I hope that you rest in peace, Roger, and I hope that you are at peace.
I know that his impact on the country is beyond a shadow of a doubt. You think that he saw Nixon in a green room?
That's right. Saw
him as an underdog guy. Says you got to like television. Next thing you know, he's helping Richard Nixon get elected.
Didn't
George
he help
Bush
Nixon?
41.
He said you got to change your message, and he started talking to him.
He said you can't hate television. It's not going away. Right. It's not a fad.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I love about this clip is that in some ways it's all true. Like, Roger Ailes did make all of these people's careers because of his unbelievably documented record as like a predator, sexual harasser, and traitor of favors for access. Every time a woman says, I wouldn't be where I was without him, you always have to be like, okay, that's interesting. And yeah, he did change the country. He did. He helped elect a unhinged war criminal directly as president when he worked for Richard Nixon. And he helped coarsen the culture and spread so many lies and systematize right-wing propaganda to such a degree that now we have Donald Trump, who makes Richard Nixon, you know, again, you know, we have dum-dum Nixon. We have all of the criminal tendencies, complete inability to handle the job, but with none of the intelligence.
Also, it's true that he put food on their tables, and even metaphorically, Susan, 66, a former model, said that when she was 16 years old, Ailes exposed his genitals to her, and she described them as red like raw hamburger.
Oh.
So
that's absolutely grotesque, and put that on the table, and yeah, it was hard work. All right, Matt, before we go to break and get to Sarah Jones, let's get some music. That was Fox and Friends. Let's do our final Roger Ailes dancing on the grave of some Hotline Bling. Yeah, I just want to wrap this up properly. We'll probably be doing this several times throughout the show. Roger Ailes. You know what's great about Roger Ailes is that, again, you could say, like with Breitbart, you could say, hey, I don't know what he was like, you know, in his private life. Maybe he's a great guy, but as a public figure, it's a net positive that he's not around.
And we also
Roger Ailes, we can know for sure that actually he was horrific and disgusting in every aspect of his life. So here we go. Roger Ailes is dead. Roger Ailes is dead. All right. We'll be right back with Sarah Jones on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Sarah Jones. She's a social media editor and contributing writer at The New Republic. Sarah, how are you?
I'm great.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being with us on Roger Ailes Day.
No, I'm flattered. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could say I timed it. Knowing that this was going to happen. But at any rate, speaking of media failures, and in some ways this is a paradox because, you know, Fox News, obviously for what it is and what Roger Ailes set out for it to be, was in fact a great success in terms of creating a kind of powerful organ of right-wing extremism and propaganda. But you've also written recently about, you know, the New York Times editorial page, which remains even in today's, you know, environment with so many different kind of outlets and fake news and not fake news and, you know, and partisanship and blah, 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 blah. The New York Times still has a kind of distinct prestige to it, particularly, I think, in the circles that we run in, even if we have a lot of contempt for many of the, you know, columnists at the Times. And you wrote a couple of weeks ago about the hiring of Brett Stevens, who's the sort of new kind of New York Times, or additional New York Times in-house conservative. They already have Ross Douthat and David Brooks opining. And you connected it to like a broader ecosystem of the New York Times editorial page is not what it could or should be. So can you explain that and Brett Stevens a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's such a strange thing because the New York Times does have this prestige that it's arguably earned. It's been doing some of the best reporting you know, of the Trump administration by far. And yet you have this editorial page, which seems so far out of step with the quality of the rest of the newspaper. And it's very strange. I mean, they hired Russ Stevens. They already had Russ Duke out. They allowed Louise Mensch to contribute an editorial recently. It's just a series of very odd editorial decisions that don't seem to have any coherent guiding philosophy behind them.
Right.
And sort of the argument that we've been given so far, you know, this, that conservative voices were underrepresented in the media just isn't persuasive. I don't believe that they're underrepresented in the media at all. If you want to talk about who's actually underrepresented, you know, there's not a socialist contributor to the New York Times editorial page right now. And socialists don't have, you know, a version of Fox News or any of the other sort of right-wing conservative media organs that we have in place at the moment. So it's not a very good argument. And it's a troubling move for a newspaper that is sort of fashioning itself as this bastion of facts and opposition to the alternative facts put forward by the Trump administration. And I think the obvious deeper problem here is sort of this, the way that they're approaching this notion of objectivity, this commitment to representing both sides. And if you're sort of approaching objectivity with no underlying political philosophy guiding you, then, you know, of course you're going to publish somebody like Brett Stevens and then tell everyone, you know, I'm just being fair, I'm just being objective.
Right. And, you know, you talk specifically about, you know, Brett Stevens in some ways. What the other kind of funny part of these Times editorial decisions, actually, there's two things going on that are really problematic. One is, as you say, if there was, I mean, the big breakout politics of 2016 have been a form of, you know, far-right neo-populist, potentially neo-fascism, neo-Confederate politics, as exemplified by the Trump administration. And the other big breakthrough has been, at the very least, genuine progressive politics, or if we're going to, you know, follow the most popular politician in the country, democratic socialist politics of Bernie Sanders. Those are the breakthroughs. And at the same time, it seems like the Times is still kind of stuck in this notion that, well, we need another conservative voice. And so they grab Brett Stevens, and you make this point as well, which is that he doesn't even represent, you know, even if you wanted to make the case that you wanted some representation of that perspective, that right-wing perspective, this sort of like pro every war in the Middle East, cut taxes for rich people, but also like, you know, Trump is unseemly, or I don't want to do anything about global warming, but instead of just saying it's a hoax and made up by the Chinese or whatever, which is like what modern Republican politics would say, this is back in the 90s, which is like, let me come up with this sort of like pseudo-intellectual, meandering, exhausting kind of piece on like, what is certainty and what is science? And then somehow that all loops to like, we shouldn't do anything about the climate crisis. So even within the bounds of what they – of the kind of flawed framework of what they're trying to do, they're still not even getting, like, they're not even mainlining what that perspective would be. That would be like hiring some, you know, Breitbart contributor, and they could write week in and week out in the New York Times editorial page about how, like, you know, I don't, you know, the new Ghostbusters is making people gay and it's Iran's fault.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, too, I sort of blame this urge that I'm seeing among liberal and centrist commentators to elevate furious Republicans like Evan McMullen, sort of the entire Never Trump crowd. And it's a weird phenomenon that I'm still kind of struggling to articulate what's behind it, other than maybe just a fetishization of institutions. Mm-hmm. Because it makes them feel comfortable and good. But I do see it as part of that trend where, you know, people are desperate to believe that sane, rational Republicans are still around and things can go back to the way they were before. But, you know, of course, like, these views are still very, very fringe.
Yeah. And do you think that that is, like, I think you nailed on it. I think there's a fetishization of institutions. You know, I talked to somebody who is very highly placed in, you know, mainstream Democratic politics a couple of months ago. And it was just kind of like, the question that I had actually was that how can people simultaneously be, you know, willing to come out and like I'll call Trump. I've made a comparisons with apartheid leaders. I think that the Confederacy and Jim Crow, like I have no problem with really recognizing the reality of what Trump and modern Republicanism represent. But I never compared the guy to Hitler. And yet there's people who would simultaneously compare the guy to Hitler, but also be like, well, you can't vote against all of his cabinet nominations because that's, you know, that's like out of bounds. Right. And what this person said to me was like, well, a lot of us still want to believe that, you know, again, not Trump himself, he's the worst thing ever, but that these people are not, they don't all have that. They don't all represent that. And yet, you know, we see yesterday, I mean, they asked Mitch McConnell, like, how do you feel about him revealing classified intel? I don't give a fuck. Whatever. And that right. to me seems to be, you know, reflecting these editorial decisions as well. It's a weird, like, it's a desire for an other side to exist that doesn't exist, at least in terms of power.
Yeah, I mean, well, the system has worked for them.
Right.
So, of course, they have a vested interest in keeping it intact. And I think that's really what it is.
Do you also think that it's somehow this notion of having, like, there's still this, and this will kind of migrate us in a second to Hillary Clinton, but this notion that instead of seeing this assault and this threat on everything that the modern Republican Party represents, from civil rights to stripping healthcare to just a kind of complete bombardment of every social advancement and basic decency in the society, that there's still this desire to like make it about Trump as a particular personality or figure versus the systemic critique. Because a lot of these same Republicans, like an Evan McMullen, would still, you know, support Paul Ryan's social Darwinism. And, you know, and Bret Stephens doesn't like Donald Trump, but he certainly would approve of every type of illogical military adventure imaginable.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, sort of this failure to grasp that is just only kind of further stoking grassroots ire at the Democratic Party and what it represents at the moment.
So you've written critically of Hillary Clinton and this new PAC and the deification of Hillary Clinton as one of your pieces. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of people that are just kind of mired in relitigating arguments in some ways that are, you know, like I would say on the flip side, like there's this new DNC lawsuit that I don't care about. Right. Like I think that there's some extent to which it's like, yeah, we got to move forward. We need to, you know, entertain other things in the world we're in, you know, with what policies are coming out of this White House and Congress that are more significant than, you know, going back to some emails from last campaign cycle. But at the same time, this way in which, and you make this point, that a narrative that's built around Hillary Clinton, that of course she's been a victim of misogyny and sexism, but just basically entirely shifts her loss to external factors outside of her campaign and her own decisions. What's that doing to politics now and the next moves forward for, you know, Democrats and progressives?
I think it's an enormous obstacle to, you know, a necessary shift for the Democratic Party. I think we have plenty of evidence right now that the sort of moderate centrism that she and her husband both represent, sort of the centrism that's guided the Democratic Party till now, just isn't working. It's not resonating with voters, and it's not what voters want. And yet you do see officials within the DNC and sort of, you know, some prominent pundits sort of doubling down on it in the face of all this evidence. And, you know, to sort of circle back to something I said a few minutes ago, I do think it, like, the system works for them, and so they want to keep it intact. And I think it's very comforting to them, but it will continue to cost them in the long run.
So, you know, when you talk about someone like specifically you're critiquing Susan Bardo's book, The Destruction of Hillary Clinton, what What does that say both about, you know, elaborate a little bit more on how the system, even under Trump and even under this far-right Congress, still works for some people in that orbit? Kind of elaborate on that. And then also, what are the different tracks of the feminist conversation in this? Because it does seem like there is one sort of lane where it just becomes about just the personification of these issues on one person. And one person who, incidentally, is obviously also, like, extraordinarily privileged.
Right, yeah. So the Susan Bordo book was interesting for a number of reasons. And one of those reasons is that, I mean, she frankly just made things up in the book. Like, it doesn't appear to have been fact-checked at all. And the rest of it just essentially rehashes things that we heard hundreds of times during
what
the
election. What did she make up
Hillary
in the book?
Clinton. I think she accused Sanders, among other things, of not condemning misogyny among his followers. And of course,
right.
that's not true.
Right.
He did. And she also mischaracterized the context of Clinton's 90s quote about super predators, which is a pretty egregious error. I'm not quite sure how that made it into the final version of the book. But it was all done sort of to construct Hillary Clinton as this radical activist figure. And you can say, you know, she's broken the glass ceiling, but that there's more to being a radical activist figure than doing that.
Right.
And it does tie into sort of this conflict that you've mentioned about different approaches to feminism. And one approach to feminism, I think you could sort of call, you know, other people have called it this as well, the lean-in approach to feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just need to get women in decision-making positions. We need to get women in power. And then, you know, sort of magically things would be good. And if a woman has achieved power, this is necessarily a victory for the feminist movement. And left-leaning feminists like myself would say, okay, wait, not so fast. You know, we have to look at what women do once they're in these decision-making positions. And also, you know, how are they achieving power in the system? You know, we think the system is inherently flawed and we'd rather focus on, you know, sort of overthrowing that. It's not enough to make a woman president.
Right.
And you saw that conflict during the primary, and then you're seeing it now.
And so then in that process, you know, this phrase, I'm sure, you know, people who watch and listen to this show will have heard me say this many times, but I've talked about this kind of pseudo-woke neoliberalism. And mm-hmm. one of the kind of paradoxes, too, is that specifically with the Clintons, you're talking about people, you know, the new crop of people that sort of fit that political profile, you know, of younger journalists and pundits and politicos in their 20s and 30s, they are probably more genuine in the sense of more right-leaning on economics or not really understanding the importance of those issues. But genuinely, and I think, you know, from a sincere place, really having very adamant feelings about social inclusion, about misogyny, about racism, about homophobia. And that fusion comes together. The irony of the Clintons is that, you know, their whole political careers have sort of tracked, you know, whatever essentially the weather vane of a particular type of kind of third wave Democratic politics was. So, you know, that super predators quote that people talk about with Hillary, it wasn't just important because it was a talking point in the campaign. It was important because this was in a context where particularly Bill, but also Hillary, were willing to exploit very significant racial anxieties to very significantly mm-hmm. expand the prison industrial complex. So they didn't even, you know, even on these kind of social issues that now they've put their beachhead on, they are relatively fair weather friends of. So in terms of like moving forward, and now, you know, there's this onward together pack that Hillary's generating, and there's still all of this conversation. And it, like, I guess at this point I'd almost ask, like, there was a time with the Clintons where they actually represented a distinct policy portfolio of which, if you're on the left like us, you disagree with. But now it's like, mm-hmm. is this just a brand? Like, is this just a brand proposition? And there's, you know, there's truth in this brand proposition. There is a tragedy to it. This is a woman, the first woman in history to win the popular vote, the first, you know, viable contender to be president that was a woman. And she was, you know, beat by like the biggest, like disgusting, boorish, misogynist imaginable. Like, I get how that upsets people. But like, what, I mean, do you see that PAC as keep this Clinton brand name floating, or, and this could possibly be both, just, you know, make sure the Democratic Party doesn't actually do anything to embrace the kind of bold and broad agenda that Bernie Sanders exemplifies, that Elizabeth Warren does to some degree, and that clearly, particularly like millennials, are demanding?
Yeah, I think it may be too early to tell.
Right.
I'm not encouraged by the fact that so far the PAC isn't disclosing its donors.
Right.
That's a matter of concern. I guess I don't have any real problems with the groups that it's announced it's funding right now, but it does seem kind of notable that, you know, more left-leaning groups were included in that list. So, you know, my colleague Cleo Chang wrote about this for the New Republic as well. You know, it's all going to come down to how she spends the money that she will inevitably raise. And I think we're just going to have to wait a little bit to see exactly who gets the money that, you know, she's going to produce. And then we'll have a clear idea of how much of this is just branding and how much of this is like a really earnest desire to fund a viable resistance to Trump and the ideology that he represents.
Where does the other conversation of this kind of the balance between the questions of gender and identity and then also the questions of like trust fund and legacy? You know, one of the, and this is even more kind of apparent, not to like sort of beat up on Chelsea Clinton. She seems like a nice enough person. I don't really have she hasn't said or done anything in public that's really struck me one way or another, but it does seem like a neatly problematic that there's even an interview question where someone would say, are you thinking about running for president in 2020? When this is like, you know, someone whose entire space and being in the modern discourse is, you know, a result of where they came from.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's extremely troubling, and I find it very strange that people have sort of transferred their affections to some degree from Hillary to Chelsea, and we're only doing this because of Chelsea's last name.
Right.
I think that does reflect a real sort of rot in the way that a lot of Americans are approaching politics and like what politics means to them and what they think about like what they think it is to do politics and accomplish change. It's more of a personality cult than anything else, and it's not the way to build a movement.
So as a final question, would you say then that like this continuing of like pivoting economic justice versus social justice, obviously, you know, to me, it creates an enormous number of straw men. The reality is, if you meet most people, even if they have blind spots and say, you know, might even say stupid things or genuinely be wrong about some things, if you meet somebody who supports universal health care, I think you could bet pretty, you know, very easy follow-up bet that that person also supports marriage equality, and that person also wants to do something serious about criminal justice reform and systemic racism and policing, right? So that the argument moving forward then, and what I get from your work and why I always recommend it to people is like, it's not the battle of these things against each other. It's actually the battle inside these things. What kind of feminism are we talking about? Are we talking about a feminism that puts the whole structure and the redistribution questions on the table? Because I don't understand how you possibly deal with something like systemic misogyny, particularly if you're factoring in race, that doesn't include questions of material redistribution and not just brand representation at the top. Is it that the future of the fight in all of these issues? It's like the battle inside what something like feminism means versus economic justice versus feminism.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, there is no conflict between economic populism and social justice. You know, we're talking like it is a social justice issue, and universal health care will benefit marginalized people the most, just as an example. So when somebody, you know, really reacts strongly against somebody else who's saying, okay, we need to talk about these economic issues as well, then I think what the logical assumption is that problem, that person really just has a problem with more left-wing economic policies,
right.
Which is not the way to achieve liberation for women, for people of color, for LGBT people, for all the other marginalized people in this country. It's really just a refusal to recognize that we have to confront capitalism as a contributing factor, as a major driving factor to the marginalization of people. And again, I think it is, you know, a reflection that people want to remain comfortable. And if it's worked for them, you know, why can't it work for other people? And that's just not the way the world works.
Yep. If capitalism is not on the table, then we're not doing the work. Sarah Jones, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us on the Majority Report.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half. We're going to take your calls, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We have a bunch of pieces of sound to get to. We've got some, you know, updates on the Trump pity party. Is Corey Lewandowski coming back? Robert Mueller. Your calls, your IMs, all of that. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens. Follow all of us on Twitter. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys. We will be right back on the fun half.